New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today, we'll be looking at drugs and culture. My guest is Mike Jay. He is a cultural historian and a freelance journalist, author of numerous books, including Psychonauts, Drugs and the Making of the Modern Mind, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic, The Influencing Machine. High Society, The Central Role of Mind-Altering Drugs in History, Science, and Culture. This Way, Madness Lies, and Emperor of Dreams, Drugs in the 19th Century. Mike is based in the United Kingdom, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Mike. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you, Jeff.
I've been reviewing your books. At first, I was really interested in interviewing you because of your most recent book on Psychonauts, which is a real big interest of mine, and I know we'll come back to it, but I've come to see you largely as not just a student of drugs and drug culture, but really a cultural historian in general, that your work touches on medicine, it touches on media, it touches on cultural history in general, and it's that large lens through which you look at the role of drugs, both on the individual and in culture as a whole.
Yeah, I'm not an academic, I'm not a specialist, and drugs is a great subject, if you're prepared to put up with the stigma, which I'm okay with. It's a great subject for a generalist, because you get to range across and often cherry pick the most interesting bits from, you know, both sides of the two cultures, from the arts and the sciences, and from medicine, and from philosophy, and from psychology, and anthropology, and our cultural life generally.
And I gather from your writing that you began this work in the 1990s.
That's right. I was a young kind of journalist. I was working in TV and film and looking around for stories. And that was a time, I mean, we think back now and, you know, that seems to be the decade of kind of when everybody was out in huge open air raves and when drug culture really took off. And that was true, certainly, at least in my experience. But there was a great silence about all this in the media. You know, drugs were always approached in a way, you know, that we still get, which is the idea that they have to be framed somehow as a problem. You know, what should we do about this drug problem? So every story was kind of about addiction or crime or crack babies or cannabis psychosis. And nobody was really talking about, well, what are these things and why do people take them and what do they do and how do they manifest more broadly in our culture? So those were the questions that I set myself. And the other thing that I was interested in at that time, I was a very early adopter on the internet. And, you know, back in the dial-up days before, all the Netscapes and browsers. And one of the very first cultures to colonize the internet was was drugs. There were all these kind of alt news groups, and that suddenly that was, you know, because there was enormous ignorance about the subject, and suddenly that was the first time I encountered a community of people who really knew what they were talking about and could talk about everything from chemical recipes to street drug prices to history and culture. And so it was, and that I think changed the language of the sort of our public conversation about drugs. So yeah, back in that moment, that was when I first started writing about the subject. And then, you know, the question that kind of popped into my mind was, well, where did all these things come from? Because I'd kind of grown up like everybody else, assuming that they kind of emerged in the 1960s. But I started to realize, of course, all these things we call drugs have much, much longer histories. They all have very different histories from different cultures and different parts of the world. And this was all fascinating and unexplored. So that was what launched me.
I guess I'm a bit older than you. I did come of age in the 1960s. and I know the 1990s, I mean, for me, drugs were almost pretty passé by the 1990s. Mm-hmm. But in the 60s, it seemed like something revolutionary was going on, not just with drugs, but of course, with computers at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I got drawn into the drug culture at the same time, roughly, that I developed an interest in parapsychology and mysticism. And I assumed that all of those things were going to have revolutionary impact. And I think if we look back today, we can say the internet did have revolutionary impact, but I'm not sure that parapsychology or the drug culture or UFOs, which was another big interest of mine in those years, I think they all still have potential to revolutionize culture, but haven't done so yet.
That's right. I think I grew up as a teenager reading a whole lot of the stuff that you were, you know, lucky enough to actually participate in firsthand. But I think part of that message that came from the 60s about drugs was from its evangelists was the idea that, wow, this is total evolutionary shift, and you know, we're going to be completely different from any previous generation of humanity, and nobody has ever done this before, you know. And that was mirrored back on the other side of the cultural divide by drug warriors going, this is an unprecedented existential threat, you know. So both sides were happy to collude in the idea that drugs had only emerged in the 60s, and there were very few people I discovered when I broke through and tried to look behind it and think, well, where did cocaine come from in the first place? You know, what was the history of cannabis before it became a street drug in the West? Suddenly there were all these fascinating stories that were very little known and very little explored, and that became a very productive, generative path for me.
You write about the use of drugs in the biological world by animals, and how the earliest humans probably discovered these drugs by watching animals.
Yeah, we get this in myth quite a lot. And if you look at the origin stories of something like coffee, for example, the story is that there was a Yemeni goat herder with his goats, and he noticed that they were chewing these particular beans and getting frisky. You know, then you cross the planet to the South Pacific, and something like kava, the narcotic drink that's used over there, you know, all the origin stories of that go back to observing animals. And that makes sense to me, because one of the odd things about psychoactive drug use is it's pretty much a human cultural universal. It's very hard to find any culture, you know, across the globe or throughout history that doesn't use psychoactive drugs in some ways. And in the famous list of human cultural universals, it was, altering your consciousness with drugs is kind of one of the couple of dozen things that we all do. So that suggests to me that we must have been doing it before we were human, that when we kind of emerged into humanity, we were coming already from a tradition of using psychoactive drugs in different ways that we can still see. I mean, other, you know, ones that we see every day that are, you know, what happens to cats when they take catnip, for example. You know, that's something that has no effect on us, but it clearly has, you know, powerful effects on them. And we know from having wired them up that they're hallucinating when they're sort of in their catnip ecstasies, and, you know, maybe it kind of, you know, sort of makes the, you know, brings them into sort of fertility as well. So there are all kinds of reasons. And then when you get to, you know, the monkeys and primates, the great apes, our closest cousins, you know, they have a lot of quite well-directed drug-seeking behavior, and they pick up drug habits very easily from us in captivity. So yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to frame the story in that way, because, you know, it gives us new perspectives on where all this might be coming from.
Well, I thought one of the most interesting stories you've written about had to do with laboratory rats and how they were given certain drugs. They had to press a button and they would get a dose of the drugs. And as I recall, some studies would show that the rats would even give up food in order to get this stimulus. But then, when you write about if the rats were taken out of their tiny little cages and given a larger environment where they could play and enjoy themselves, they preferred not to have the drug.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. I mean, that goes back to sort of post-war 1950s experiments on rats, where people wired them up and found what they thought was a pleasure center in their brain, where they would keep on stimulating themselves and, you know, sort of pushing that little lever until they dropped. So, I mean, it's actually now, you know, we don't necessarily think that they are experiencing pleasure. We think that that was probably something more like desire than pleasure, just a compulsion to repeat. But it became a measure when people were trying to test or evaluate the addictiveness of different drugs. How many times will this rat push the lever? And that's going to tell us, you know, how many times more addictive cocaine is than heroin or whatever. And yeah, it was this Canadian experimenter called Bruce Alexander who came to wonder what we were actually testing here. So he thought he'd set up a control, which he called Rat Park, which was a very rich environment for rats, in which rats, who are, of course, naturally gregarious, could all live together. They had even painted little trees and forests in the backdrop and gave them all kinds of toys to play with. And in this environment, then, they weren't very interested in the drugs. And if you gave them water with sugar in and water with morphine in, they'd pick the plain water over the morphine water. And if they had injuries, they'd drink the morphine water until their injuries had healed, and then they'd drop it and just go back to the sugar water or the plain water. So Bruce Alexander said, well, what are we really testing here? Are we really testing the addictiveness of the drugs, or are we actually testing just how much, you know, pain and misery we're inflicting on these little rats in cages?
I think it says a lot about the human condition. And for example, the apparent epidemic of prescription drug use in our society today may be more a reflection of our social conditions than the addictiveness of these drugs or the way the pharmaceutical companies are pushing them.
I think that's certainly right. And I think it's, you know, it's part and parcel of modernity. If you look at the rise in these drugs from cocaine in the late 19th century and then amphetamines and also sedatives, opiates, and then later barbiturates, you know, this is a time in our society when you know, we're having to work more and more to the dictates of the machine and the factory and the office. And, you know, we have very regimented days where we have to be up at a certain time and we have to, you know, be always on in our work times. And then when we get to our leisure time in the evening, it's very brief and we want to make the most of it. And I think in those situations, you know, in this sort of circumstance in which we live, stimulants and sedatives are very useful. And you can see how they're kind of so much part of all our days of, you know, waking up and having that morning coffee and then like a gear change in the evening with a beer or a glass of wine. And, you know, there's a as you say, a prescription element to this. You know, these stimulants and sedatives are prescribed for all kinds of different conditions, depression and anxiety and so on. And they were very widely prescribed at different times in the 20th century. And then they're also, you know, once we look at our street drugs, our illicit drugs, there's a lot of cocaine and amphetamines and, you know, these days, certainly a lot of Valiums and sedatives. So it seems to me that there's something about our modern lifestyle that makes it natural for us to have recourse to these things that can, as it were, speed up time or slow it down or give us a bit more energy temporarily or take it away.
I suppose it's fair to say that throughout human history and in most cultures, the primary drug has been alcohol.
That's been the case in Western culture, not so much in other cultures around the world, in Asia or in the Americas. I think, you know, people talk about the psychoactive revolution as being a long process that we're going through that started really with Columbus and the sort of first voyages and the beginning of global trade. And a lot of those early commodities that drove global trade were sugar, tobacco, coffee, tea. And these went from being very specific to a certain culture to becoming, tobacco was the first, I guess, that became a global drug that got exported around the world in all kinds of different ways. So when the Portuguese took it to Africa, where people developed the habit of smoking it with sort of big pipes, and then kind of round to Asia, where people developed water pipes and then started chewing it and so on. So I think, you know, we could maybe see, if we went back 500 years, the drug habits, the sort of global drug habits, would be a patchwork where there would be one or two particular drugs that were accepted in each particular culture. And what's happened over the last few centuries of the sort of globalization has been like these little patches all running together into a multicolored kind of ever more complex tapestry where everybody is taking everybody else's drugs as well as their own.
You've written about drugs that are used by hundreds of millions of people, to which I have personally never been exposed, like kava.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found kava fascinating. I mentioned it earlier, and I was lucky enough to spend some time in the South Pacific in Vanuatu, and I became fascinated by that as a different type of drug culture, because it's really a drug monoculture. Kava is all there is. I mean, this is a part of the world where, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, economic activity, and things that come from a long way are expensive. So, you know, a beer or a packet of cigarettes, you know, was pretty expensive. Most people didn't have access to them. But what they did was have access to kava, which is a drink that has to be prepared fresh. It's from the root of a pepper. So people go up in the afternoon and dig up this big pepper root, and then they sit around in the late afternoon grating it up and mixing it with water and making this kind of rather milky suspension that then people sit around in the evening and drink out of coconut shells. And it's very variable. It's exclusively a cultivar now. Everybody, you know, there's no wild kava, but everybody has grown their own type of kava that they favour for particular occasions. So it's very socially coded. You know, there are certain types of kava that you would bring to a wedding, and it would be different if you were from the in-laws' family. You know, so there's a lot of ritual associated with it, and particularly when different communities meet. But it's also something that people do socially in the evening, like we do with beers. You know, we sit around and drink it, and you know, everything goes kind of quiet, and you listen to the surf on the beach. But people have quite deep experiences with it. They can break out of that circle and go and sit on the beach and listen, and maybe in the waves they'll hear the voice of their ancestors, or they'll hear a prophecy. You know, quite often that's how religious movements get going there. So we have these neat little pigeonholes. Oh, this is a recreational drug, and that's a medical drug, and this is a sort of ritual drug, or that's a sacrament. But yeah, something like kava I find very interesting, because it's all of these things at the same time.
You pointed out that there is a sexist component to kava, as well as certain other drugs, that it's something the men do together.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite, I mean, a lot of social activity is kind of demarcated by gender, you know, in every society around the world. And often one of the ways this is demarcated is with drug use. So yeah, kava traditionally is a male thing. It would only be men who would prepare it in the afternoon, and they would be in a special sacred place where women aren't allowed to tread and so on. But when you go to kava bars in the towns and cities, kind of everybody's doing it. In the same way that if you look at the West now and look at the prevalence of, say, a drug like cocaine or ecstasy, you know, they're pretty much split across the genders. So I don't think there's anything kind of intrinsic about drugs being a male or a female thing. But what I think they are is, you know, as in many, many other ways, they're very good at demarcating social differences. And I think they particularly tap into that idea that the female social space is domestic, is in the home, is child rearing and is cooking. And the male space is around kind of ritual and intoxication and, you know, sort of private male society. So you often see those map onto each other. Yeah.
In fact, just this morning, I ran into a magazine article, or it was an advertisement, suggesting, and now that I think about it, it was actually an article suggesting it's okay now for women to drink beer.
Right. Okay. So there you go. I guess that's progress from the male half of the population anyway. Yeah. I mean, but you could say the same about social class as you could with gender here. You know, here in Britain, you know, we drink tea a lot, as you know, and you know, most of us drink tea out of a mug, usually a kind of tannin stained mug. But if you went some stately home, you'd be served in porcelain cups with a sort of tea set, and probably you'd get a different set of cups from, you know, if royalty visited, they'd get something a little higher grade. And this is a bit like if you look at betel nut chewing in Asia, for example. You know, betel nut sets can be very simple things, just like a little board that you put across your knee, but they can often be very, very fine and fancy, lacquered with that red Chinese lacquer, with little pockets, you know, like little tiffin box sets for all the different elements that you're going to fold into your betel leaf. So I think you could say the same about drugs and class and social status as well.
When it comes to the use of drugs, there's also the prohibition that surrounds certain drugs. In some cases, like in the 1920s in the United States, the prohibition was quite severe. But there's always these a variety of ways of getting around the prohibition.
Yeah, that's right. I think, as I said, you know, you don't get so many drug prohibitions if you look at history, because, you know, if you go back far enough, people would just have their own drugs that they recognized and used, and it wouldn't occur to anybody to use a different drug. You don't have to go very far back in our culture for that. If you go back to, say the 1950s, and you look at cannabis, that was kind of seen as a deviant habit. You know, that you might find if you're a black jazz musician, you might encounter it, but if you were, you know, living out in the suburbs, you wouldn't, you know, and there was really no need to prohibit cannabis very heavily back in those days to straight middle class society, because how would anybody get hold of it? How would they know what to do with it? And they wouldn't enjoy it once they did. So I think prohibition is something that happens kind of as part of this globalization of drugs, where new drugs come in from other parts of the world. And they're often seen as foreign. You know, our drugs is a word that we don't really apply to our own drugs. Nobody calls a coffee a drug. Nobody calls a beer a drug. You call them drugs when they come from somewhere else, right? So I think the prohibition of drugs is really about kind of sort of demarcating what's our culture and what isn't, you know, and, you know, there was a sense in, I think, in the 1920s from the people who were pushing prohibition was that real Americans, you know, were kind of from an older Anglo-Saxon culture and they went to church and they were very religious and America was now being invaded, as they would say, by, you know, people from Ireland and Italy and Germany and from these drinking cultures. And there were more people going to the saloons than there were to the church. And it was kind of about making a stand that, you know, we in America are not, you know, these kind of drinking, dissolute people. And you can see how the war on drugs has unfolded in the same way. You know, so much of it is about, you know, it's not about challenging our right to have a martini or a cigar. It's about those other drugs that those different people take.
I understand that maybe in the 18th century or 17th century, coffee itself was regarded as rather scandalous.
Yeah, it was. I mean, all of these things were banned at different times in different places. Tobacco was banned. Chocolate was banned. Well, it was kind of exclusively available to Jesuits. And, you know, you could be slung in jail, you know, as, you know, Columbus's shipmates were slung in jail when they came back smoking tobacco pipes. And so coffee definitely was something that was suspicious, that came from outside and had to have a new kind of social space made for it. The coffee house in 17th and 18th century Europe and Britain particularly. And that became kind of rapidly quite an upmarket space, quite middle class. The idea was if you didn't want to go to a tavern and start drinking your beer at 11 o'clock in the morning, then you could go where all the other smart business people went and to a coffee house and drink maybe coffee, maybe tea, maybe even beer. You could get that there too, but the newspapers would be there and it would be a place for slightly more elevated conversation. So, yeah, coffee went from being a kind of suspicious outsider drug to becoming a mark of status.
Well, to jump around a little bit, Mike, I'd like to talk about the use of drugs in the ancient world, and in particular, drugs associated with religious ecstasy, like the mysterious soma that's written about in the Rig Veda, one of the oldest spiritual scriptures on the planet, or the suggestion that drugs were central to the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece.
As we've already mentioned, you know, there are very few cultures, you know, going back through history where psychoactive drugs, or mostly plants at that time, aren't used in some ways, and they definitely had religious or spiritual uses. The Rig Veda, as you say, kind of talks a lot about soma, which it describes in various ways as a plant, or, you know, it might be a combination of plants, but certainly something that was used in a ceremonial way and prepared by a priest craft. And later in that history got kind of substituted with other non-intoxicating substitutes. It seems to me that tends to happen once you get texts coming along and religions of the book, and particularly once religions leave their original kind of tightly controlled cultural milieu and start spreading, you know, whether through conversion or adoption, to all kinds of other cultures. Then you've got other cultures where these traditional sacraments don't have quite the same meaning. But once this is a literate culture, then the text can be the thing that spreads the message. So I think soma speaks to a time that isn't very well documented in ancient literature, that's mostly pre-literate, but a time when, you know, much as you might see in somewhere like the Amazon or Central America today among indigenous people, there are lots of different plants which have different psychoactive properties and used in ritual and ceremony and take up a very central kind of important place in the culture.
Some religions seem to be centered around drugs. There's been some literature suggesting that the Catholic Mass, that the earliest Christians, when they had Mass and drank wine and ate the wafer, that those were psychoactive substances.
There's such a enormous number of things that feed into that culture as it emerges. It's certainly possible that some of those involved, plants and intoxicating plants.
And then there are new religions today, like the Native American Church or Santo Daime, where the religion, again, centers on the idea of a psychoactive substance, sometimes very powerful, like ayahuasca or peyote, as the central ritual of the church.
Yeah, that's right. I've been very lucky in spending some time with Native American church members, particularly among the Comanche people, who are one of the first people to adopt the peyote. And I've been fascinated by the story because, of course, this wasn't a traditional part of their culture in their times of freedom. It was only in forced captivity on the reservations that what was initially called the peyote religion and then later became the Native American church was adopted. And this was, I think, something that emerged from prohibition, in the sense that one of the things that was prohibited on the reservations by the missionaries and the federal officers was singing and dancing, you know, the ghost dance, obviously, after Wounded Knee, but also the sun dance. And this was really so central, I think, to Native American culture, this communal trance, this idea of everybody being together in an ecstatic space, or all altering their consciousness together, that once that couldn't be done through singing and dancing, peyote presented itself as another way. And I think that's why the peyote meeting takes place in a teepee at night, because it was clandestine. It was hidden. You were hiding it from the authorities, but it created this space where the old ways were still alive. And it was kind of like the old, life of freedom in microcosm around the fire. And it kept that culture going and nurtured it through, you know, two generations of, genocide, really, an intense cultural repression. And it became a real focus for Native American culture and its survival. I think what's happened with the Santo Daime churches in Brazil, which are very, very popular in the big cities, in Rio and Sao Paulo, where so many people are, from poor working classes with very little, participation in the urban culture. But everybody had grandparents who were from the jungle, from the Amazon, and they have roots in that culture and in sort of shamanism. So I think it's no surprise that in those contexts, then Santo Daime, which is kind of a sort of branch of Catholicism, but very inflected with indigenous language and with the ayahuasca as its sacrament, you can see how strongly appealing that is to lots of second generation urban arrivals from the Amazon and from that indigenous world.
One of the most fascinating things that you've written about is the idea that using a drug is really a learned process. At first, they don't taste good. They may not even feel good. People vomit. The reaction can be very unpleasant. It might even be thought of as poisonous or pathological. So to take a substance that is regarded as a poison and to turn it into something of a religious ritual to attain a state of ecstasy requires a series of steps that any individual has to go through.
That's right. We probably, and I'm sure some of us had our first sip of whiskey or inhaled our first lung full of tobacco and thought, wow, this is great. But I think for the majority of people, it's pretty unpleasant. So you wouldn't persist unless you had a sense that there was a reward to be had at the end of it. So I think that's a sort of meaning that certain drugs build up in certain cultures that, you know, this is actually great if you learn how to do it. And yeah, there was some wonderful work by a psychologist in the 1950s looking at cannabis and, well, becoming a marijuana user. His the paper was called, and it said, well, first of all, obviously you've got to learn how to smoke a joint or whatever, but then you've got to recognize the effects. And most people, the first few times they smoke a joint, they don't notice anything much, or maybe they just pass out. But you've kind of got to learn that this sort of dizzy feeling is actually kind of pleasant, and it's, you know, this sort of slight crazy intensity is, if you're sharing it with other people, can be very funny and goofy, and you can make strange imaginative connections that other people can share. And, you know, eventually, if you, you know, smoke cannabis with other people of sort of similar frame of mind, then you can all decide that you're having a good time. But it's not something that happens instantly. It's something that has to be developed.
You have to learn to even recognize the symptoms and then have a label or some way of identifying that these things are positive.
That's right. And you have to, yeah, and you have to have a sense of a use to which they can be put. You know, I think that's true of a lot of psychoactive drugs. They're, you know, they're very useful. They extend our reach and our range in certain ways. You know, if you've got a long drive to do, you might want to have a strong coffee, you know, or if you're sort of a, you know, a professional, if a truck driver or whatever, you know, you've probably got your supply of pills that keep you awake. And, you know, there's nothing particularly pleasant about these initially. They're kind of bitter to taste, but then you learn that they've got a function, and then after that you seek them out, and you know, you figure out where you can buy them, and if they're not legal, you figure out how you can get them some other way. And yeah, so, but if you didn't have a sense of a use that you were going to put these things to, then they wouldn't be quite so interesting. And I think we see that, you know, with psychedelics also. One of the things that, looking at the history of psilocybin mushrooms, which of course suddenly became, you know, fascinating to our Western culture in the 1950s, when Gordon Wasson went to Mexico and discovered a culture in which they were still being used, and met Maria Sabina, the traditional healer who gave him his first dose of mushrooms. And then from that, we elaborated the idea that this was kind of a sacrament of an ancient pre-Christian religion. And also then he passed them, these mushrooms, on to Albert Hofmann, who identified psilocybin in them. So it was a double whammy. Not only were these mushrooms part of some hidden, secret, suppressed ancient practice, but they also, you know, cutting edge chemistry validated that they had this new drug in that we didn't know about before. So from that point on, you know, magic mushrooms are fascinating to our culture. But before that, I've kind of gone back and looked at this and wondered where they are, because of course here in Britain, they grow everywhere. And there are quite a lot of accounts of accidental intoxications, where you see some doctor has written up, I saw somebody who'd been foraging for mushrooms and they'd eaten some, and they were in a very crazy state and delirious, and their pupils were dilated and they thought they were going mad. And if you look at all these experiences, they're all terrible bad trips, you know, because, you know, if you don't know what you're expecting, if you don't know that there's, you know, a mystical revelation or a healing experience to come, then the first thing you think is, well, I've eaten some mushrooms that aren't agreeing with me. I'm feeling these strange sensations. Maybe they're poisonous. Maybe I'm going to die. And so you carry that to your doctor, and your doctor says, okay, we'd better give you a stomach pump. You know, so that's a completely different context for the experience. And, you know, it's no surprise that all those experiences were thought of as, you know, toxic episodes and not to be sought out or repeated.
We're starting to put our fingers here on the question of consciousness itself, and the idea that particularly the psychedelics seem like powerful vehicles for altering consciousness. But in some instances, people enter into a state of paranoia In other instances, people, there's a word metanoia. It's like a very thin line between a higher state of consciousness and a lower state of consciousness. And culture seems to have a lot to do with that.
That was one of the fascinating things about psychedelics and other psychoactive drugs. I think I've written a lot about the discovery of nitrous oxide and ether and chloroform, which, as well as, you know, turning out to be incredibly useful as medical anesthetics, also gave people these incredibly intense moments of, sort of transport and revelation. You know, you'd inhale them and suddenly you'd start to feel as if your body and, mind were coming unglued from one another. And then you might have an out-of-body experience. So then you come back to Earth with this sense that you've had the whole secret of life revealed to you. And these were the kind of experiences that before that point, people knew about them, but they were visionary experiences. They were usually interpreted in religious terms, or else they happened in extremis, you know, when you were in a delirium or a high fever or a psychotic episode or near death or something. And then once these drugs were discovered, suddenly it was possible for anybody to have these experiences more or less whenever they wanted them. You just had to have a decent chemistry set or access to what you wanted. And then I think that also broadened people's understanding. All kinds of experiences that would have been seen automatically as religious or spiritual experiences, some people still experienced them that way, but other people thought, maybe this is some part of the mind that I'm not normally in touch with that's talking to me. You know, maybe this is just some glitch in my brain, or, you know, maybe there's another dimension out there and these entities I'm meeting exist on the astral plane. Or suddenly there was a great plethora of possible interpretations. So drugs on the one hand made these experiences more easy to attain, and then also made it more easier to find a whole different range of possible understandings of what they might mean.
As a cultural historian, I guess one of the biggest questions that comes up is, what role do drugs play in the arts and in literature and drama?
We talk a lot about medicine and healing, and then we talk a lot about spiritual experience. But I think with all of these things, it's kind of hard to generalize. And I think it is with art and creativity too, because that has many different stages. There's a stage of incubation or inspiration, you know, before you start creating the work. And obviously that draws on experience, and drugs are very intense experiences, you know, whether good or bad. So if people have those experiences, they feed into their art in all kinds of ways. And then, you know, there's the moment of actual creation when you're really in the kind of grip of it. And there are, you know, plenty of examples of people who wrote on amphetamines or whatever for energy. But I think by and large, you know, that kind of writing, literature or musical composition tends to be best done straight. I think where that moment of inspiration is really kind of where you really see drugs being involved in that process a lot is much more with music and dance and, improvisation and things where you're in the element, particularly groups of people who are all in an altered state of consciousness together. So, I think there's, and I think that goes much deeper than the sort of question of whether drugs kind of make people more creative or inspire art or not. Once again, I'd be keen to patch them into a broader culture and part of our broader experience that can be used in so many different ways at different stages of the process.
To the extent that art emerges from bohemian types of culture, those are the same cultures where drugs have been used even when the mainstream culture was not.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And that starts, I think, with the Romantic movement, which privileged, personal individual experience. You know, it was art became, you know, less about being formally accomplished and being able to paint or write beautifully. It was more about whether, you know, the strength of your feeling and your sensations and how well you could communicate your individual experience. And I've met the discovery of nitrous oxide, for example, which I think is really the beginning of what we now call psychedelic science, you know, which happened in a medical clinic in around 1800 with Humphrey Davy, the chemist, synthesizing it and inhaling, you know, big balloons of it. And the first thing he did was like, I must take this to my friends, the romantic poets, Robert Southey and then Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who joined in the experiments. And then we think of figures like Thomas de Quincey, who, you know, in the Confessions of an Opium Eater, who kind of figured out a new way of writing memoir. I'm going to write this about my relationship with opium. That's going to be the way that you're going to get my story, and you'll get opium's story as well mingled in with it. And then by the mid 19th century in Paris, I've written a lot about the Club des Hashishins, the hashish club, which was sort of convened by a couple of doctors in mid-century Paris who were very interested to see what all these literary figures would make of swallowing a very large dose of hashish and sitting around the dinner table. And that was pretty much a roll call of all the sort of famous, you know, Dumas and Flaubert and Balzac and everybody. So the readers of French literature in the 19th century pretty rapidly had all kinds of exotic and fantastical descriptions of the sort of hashish trips that their authors were having. And that was very much part of being a bohemian world, being cut loose from, you know, the old hierarchies and the old structures. And once you had groups of people who could set their own rules and behave in the way they wanted, you know, that's when you also get, you know, other phenomena you'll remember from the 60s, like people growing their hair long and staying up all night and, you know, kind of indulging in kind of, you know, much sort of looser, more permissive sexual relations, you know. So I think, you know, that was a whole bunch of sort of bohemian cultural tropes that came together, you know, a long time before the 60s did.
Also, there is the intersection of drug use with ritual magic, I suppose, epitomized by the work of Aleister Crowley.
The magical orders at that time, like the Order of the Golden Dawn that Crowley was a member of, officially did not encourage drug use, and they didn't use it in their ceremonies. And MacGregor Mathers, who sort of was the founder of the order, kind of felt that this was low and profane, and you know, it sapped the will and the you know, and but there were plenty of people within his circle. W.B. Yeats was, I guess, the first sort of well-known one before Crowley, who was also a member of the Society for Psychical Research, which was much the same in that, you know, the distinguished professors and scientists who ran it didn't officially encourage people to take drugs and experience altered states of consciousness and describe their experiences. But there were plenty of people within those societies who did. And so Yeats and Maud Gonne, a woman who he was obsessed with, who was also a spiritual adept, they worked together a lot with chloroform and hashish and possibly peyote as well, doing guided meditations and astral travel together. But that was pretty much a quiet thing. By the time you get to Crowley in the early 20th century, drugs are definitely kind of a sort of a bad thing, and you know, nobody wants to be associated with them, of course, except for the wickedest man in the world. So unlike people like Yeats of the generation before, Crowley trumpeted and advertised his drug use and used it as kind of part of his mystique. And he's fascinating because he used pretty much every mind-altering drug that was available at the time. He sought them out systematically. He went to Park Davis Pharmaceuticals in Detroit to ask them to make a special preparation of their peyote tincture, a specially strong one that he could use. And he used chloroform and ether and hashish. And, you know, so he's a fascinating barometer of that. But of course, he kind of, most of those kind of faded away. But the one that stuck with him, unfortunately, was, you know, heroin, to which he developed a dependency, and which was very humiliating for him because he was, well, he prided himself on his superior will, but he was, you know, forced to associate with all kinds of people he regarded as low grade and undesirable to keep it going. So he's a fascinating case study in the uses and abuses and the potentials and the dangers of drug-induced altered states in spiritual practice.
That brings up the word narcotics, and when it comes to illegal drugs, that's probably the most frightening word. And heroin, of course, being at least to my knowledge, among the strongest of the narcotics. Although I've heard that tobacco might even be more addicting than heroin, for all I know.
Narcotics is a curious word because, I mean, it goes all the way back to ancient Greece, to Dioscorides, who was the first kind of great pharmacologist. And it just means something that makes you sleep. And so narcotics for Dioscorides were opium, but also belladonna and henbane and all those nightshades and so on. And they were the drugs that people were most concerned about in the late 19th century, as we got towards the era of temperance and running up to alcohol prohibition. And the word drugs at that point didn't have the meaning that we're using it, you know, with now. I mean, because drugs just meant anything that you could get at a pharmacy, as it still does. We still say drugstore. And, you know, you could go into a high street pharmacist and buy heroin or hashish or cocaine. So when people started using drugs in this kind of cautionary or disapproving way, they had to specify which drugs. So people tended to say narcotics. And so then when it came to 1914 and the Harrison Act, and which was where the sale of these drugs was criminalized for the first time, what were we talking about? We were talking about heroin and morphine and also cocaine. And so cocaine became kind of officially classified as a narcotic, even though it was in fact the strongest stimulant known to man at that time, you know, and it was anything but a narcotic. It didn't make you sleep. It kept you awake for days if you wanted. So narcotics then became, I guess, the sort of medico-legal term for illicit drugs. And that's why it's still with us and still has this kind of heavy, bad vibe to it.
Well, let's talk about heroin. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, William Burroughs, a great writer, was used heroin, and I think praised it. Is that correct?
Yes, he certainly did. It's had, it's had its devotees throughout history. Having at the same time that William Burroughs was writing about heroin, people like Jean Cocteau were writing about opium, and both of them very influenced by De Quincey and the sort of opiated literature of the 19th century, which had taken on these associations of kind of decadent fantasy and indulgence and orientalism and exoticism. William Burroughs was his first book was called Junkie, was about his heroin addiction, and by the time of his famous book Naked Lunch, he was trying to give it up, and trying different miracle cures, a drug called apomorphine that he was convinced was going to get him off it. But for Burroughs, I think it was really, control was a very kind of central theme in his work. Who's trying to control us? You know, how can we be independent of control? So I think that's what fascinated him about heroin, was that it was kind of supposedly controlled, but in fact you could get hold of it and you could live this life that was nothing like the life you're supposed to live. But then, of course, you know, sooner rather than later, probably it's the heroin starts controlling you, and that becomes, you know, the specter of control.
How addictive is heroin, actually? Do you know, for example, is it more or less addictive than nicotine?
I think it's both of them have kind of have sort of pharmacological components that make them habit forming, but there's, you know, as we talk about set and setting a lot in the terms of psychedelics and how much the context affects it. I think the same is true of heroin and tobacco. I mean, an awful lot of people go into hospital, you know, have maybe major surgery and probably spend a few weeks on morphine or some other opiate. And when they come away from that, then, you know, they're probably clinically addicted and they might easily spend a few nights, you know, sort of sweating and shivering and not sleeping well. But, you know, they're out of hospital. They're back into their life that didn't have heroin in it before. And, you know, they don't, you know, they put up with it and get over it. Whereas if you're living a life, you know, with stress and trauma and pain, which has driven you to resort to heroin, then, you know, if you can stop taking it and you go back into that same life again, you know, you're obviously, you know, an awful lot more likely to go back to it, to medicate all the things that you were taking it for in the first place. I mean, I think it's hard to measure, but it's interesting to me that if you look at tobacco and nicotine, I mean, nicotine patches, presumably, you know, if we're, all we're talking about is a pharmacological addiction, it makes no difference whether you're smoking a cigarette or sticking a nicotine patch on yourself. But nicotine patches obviously don't do it for everybody. They do it for, you know, a significant minority of people. So I think you would suggest, you know, that also suggests that nicotine is much more, as we would say, addictive for some people and for others and in some situations than others. If you look at where tobacco use really started, one of the things, you know, in the sort of 17th century, one of the great spreaders of it was the 30 Years' War. And I always think, you know, if you look at the history of warfare, you know, that's really when you want cigarettes. You know, your life is kind of 90% sitting around bored and doing nothing, and then 10% kind of crisis and, you know, fear and danger. And, you know, it seems to me that's the kind of situation where cigarettes come in very, very handy for kind of, you know, because they can sort of focus you, or they can calm you down, or you can, they're very social, you can share them with other people. So I think a lot of what we call addiction, you know, some of it can be quantified in pharmacological and clinical terms, but I think an awful lot of it, again, is cultural.
That's very interesting. Well, Mike, this has been a fascinating excursion into a wide realm. I know we've just scratched the surface. I certainly hope to have you back for some interviews where we can go into greater depth. You've written an entire book just on mescaline.
It's an absolute pleasure, Jeff, to have this conversation with you. It'd be great to talk again.
I would love to spend an hour talking to you just about mescaline and the history of psychedelics. That alone fascinates me. And cannabis has another story all of its own, and psilocybin has yet another. So I look forward to having more interviews with you, and I'm just delighted to be able to share the breadth of your knowledge with the New Thinking Aloud audience.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, Jeff. Thank you very much indeed for the privilege.
Well, thank you for being with me. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.